For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Friends, welcome to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 92.7 and 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. Got a great show lined up for you today. A couple of good interviews and lots of important news to discuss. So we'll get right to it. Here, the number of Americans who say that the initial invasion of Iraq was a good idea has gone up. Now, don't get me wrong, it's still a super majority of the American people who say that continuing the war is not worth it. A super majority of the American people are against the war in Iraq, finally. Well, they have been that way, actually, for a little while now. But the number of people who say that it was still a good idea to invade Iraq in the first place has gone up. From 35% in May to 42% now. Well, according to the New York Times. What's the explanation for that? I have a guess. I don't know this, but I have a guess at the explanation. I think that the explanation is TV keeps saying that it's the Iraqis' fault that everything's going so badly there. Oh, those darn ungrateful savages. They just cannot get their act together. Remember, Condoleezza Rice used to say, "You're a racist." You're like the kind of person who wants to make Rosa Parks sit at the back of the bus if you don't support America's invasion of Iraq. Based on faith that Arabs are just as good at having a democracy as we are. Well, first of all, democracy sucks. Second of all, we suck at having one. Third of all, there is no history of democracy in Mesopotamia ever. It is a tribal society. And now here they are, basically, according to their own argument, the war party are now all a bunch of bigots. According to their own argument, the Iraqi people are just too Stone Age to come into the modern world with us. It's all their fault. Here, we've given them such a wonderful opportunity to be free, and they've blown it. That's what Hillary Clinton says. That's what Barack Obama says. It's all the Iraqis' fault. And that's what TV says over and over and over again. And so now, some substantial proportion of the population who had been forced by reason and knowledge, or, you know, spin in the direction of reason and knowledge at least, to admit to themselves that they were wrong for supporting the aggressive invasion of Iraq, a country that never attacked us, that was no threat to us, that a war that, in Michael Scheuer's words, broke the back of America's effort against Al-Qaeda, the guys who knocked those towers down. Those people who've had to admit to themselves how wrong they were have been given an out. And a substantial number of them, apparently, according to the New York Times poll anyway, have taken it. Oh yeah, it's not my fault hundreds of thousands of Iraqis are dead. It's not America's fault. It's not the population of America who, by a super-duper majority of 75%, supported Bush in his aggressive invasion of this country that was no threat to us and had no ties to Al-Qaeda whatsoever, had never attacked us. Might as well have been, you know, Fiji or Argentina or something, as far as how much of a threat to the United States it was. And they're taking that out. Boy, thanks a lot, Democrats and TV, for blaming it all on Iraq so I don't have to take responsibility for encouraging my government to embark on an aggressive war of mass murder, pain, death, and destabilization, which of course is cardinal sin, number one. Well, I got news for you, folks. The war in Iraq was wrong. If you supported the initial invasion of Iraq, you were wrong. Not just on the facts, every one of which you and the people you followed got wrong, but you were morally wrong in the very worst way imaginable. In fact, I think I remember from when I was a kid, murder is one of the seven deadly sins. It's one of those sins that, you know, you have to really, really beg Jesus to let you into heaven after you've killed somebody. There are hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead in a war that America started. And I remember people telling, oh, what, you think we ought to just wait around till Iraq attacks us first? Well, yes, of course. Unless you want to turn your wonderful limited republic into Germany. Yeah, that's how it's supposed to work. Only in self-defense do you use violence. Somehow, you know, our entire lifetime's worth of learning that lesson can be erased by George W. Bush telling us otherwise. I mean, imagine that. You people in the supermajority out there, not just were you duped, you were duped by George W. Bush. The stupidest person I can think of, you know, that I've ever had experience with in my life. Yeah. Anyway, it's wrong to start a war. How do you like that? It is wrong to start a war. It is wrong to cheerlead your government when your government is trying to start a war. It is wrong to mass murder people who have not ever done anything to you. I mean, hell, the only reason they painted Saddam Hussein into this big Hitler was to justify America's aggressive war against him in 1991. Oh, for the defense of the nation state of Kuwait, for the defense of the monarchy in Kuwait, which was British interest, not even American interest at the time anyway. Oh no, that was a defensive war on behalf of those poor, unfortunate, innocent Kuwaitis. But that's why they blew this Saddam Hussein up into a Hitler. He was already a mass murderer, tin pot dictator, instigator of aggressive war on America's behalf against Iran. But no, they had to build him up into a Hitler in order to justify waging a war against him. And then they never could back down from that. That's why Bush and Cheney and everybody took so much heat for leaving Saddam in power in 1991. Well, geez, if this guy's Hitler, well, then you shouldn't have left him in power. Well, he wasn't Hitler. He was Tony Soprano. That's what he was. I mean, the guy was a mass murderer, particularly in wartime. Saddam Hussein's dictatorship was brutal. Never mind the fact that his wartime was always backed by the United States of America, first in the invasion of Iran, and second when they gave him the green light to go ahead and invade Kuwait on July 25th, 1990. But anyway, so here they built up this giant myth of Saddam Hussein as Hitler in order to justify aggressive war against that country. And so far, somewhere between 600,000 and a million Iraqis have been killed. That's a lot. 4 million have been displaced. 2 of them have not been able to even leave the country, but have been forced out of their homes and neighborhoods within Iraq. Another 2 million have been lucky enough to escape to Jordan or Syria or what have you. All of the ethnic minorities, the small ethnic minorities, the Mandeans and the Assyrian Christians and Chaldeans and all those people, they've all been chased out. They're gone. The Iraqi Christian society that has existed there for 2,000 years no longer exists. How do you like that, born-agains? Trying to bring back Jesus faster, huh? And if it's at the expense of innocent Christian lives, because of course those are the only ones that count, right? If it's at the expense of Christian lives in Iraq, oh well, to hell with them, right? American Christians out there, isn't that right? To hell with the Iraqi Christians? If that's what happens as a result of America's invasion? Okay, just so we have that clear, what's most important to you? Forcing Jesus to come back to kill even more people faster is more important to you than the lives of individual Iraqi Christians in Iraq. Just so that, you know, you have to admit that to yourself. And you know, this war so far has cost the American people over $1 trillion. Much of it borrowed from the Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans, which just means that there's another, you know, a few $100 billion worth of interest on top of the $1 trillion borrowed. Joseph Stiglitz, the economist, says that by the time all this is over with paying the benefits for the soldiers and all that, this will cost the American people $2.5 trillion for this revenue neutral war. Remember, Iraq's oil is going to pay for the whole war. It's going to be great. Remember that? War is now going to cost $2.5 trillion. And I really don't have time to go into all the ways to count how this has undermined American society and liberty here at home. But no, you weak, pathetic cowards who think it's okay now for you to blame the Iraqis instead of yourselves for supporting this war, it's you. You're the one. It's your fault. They're dead, and it's on your hands. Sleep tight. Or better, blame the Iraqis, right? This is America. This isn't the land where, you know, we accept responsibility for our behavior. No. This is the United States of America, where when we aggressively invade your country and get hundreds of thousands of people killed and prop up the Iran factions to rule over you, and you refuse to submit to the Iran factions and the American military might in due time, and it's all your fault. Those damn ungrateful, savage Iraqis who have denied themselves this wonderful opportunity that we have attempted to give them. That's the line. That's what Barack Obama says. That's what Hillary Clinton says. And, you know, we all know how it goes in the United States of America. When Republicans and Democrats agree about something, that's proof that it's true. That's right. It's all the people of Iraq's fault that they got themselves invaded and got their society destroyed by their invaders. Darn ungrateful savages.
I think of me and Shelly. She's my type of hype, and I can't stand when brothers tell me that I should quit chasing and look for something better. But the smile that she shows makes me a go-getter. I haven't gone as far as asking if I could get with her. I just play love by ear and hope she gets the picture. I'm shooting for her heart, got my finger on the trigger. She can be my broad, and I can be her nigga. But all I can do is stay up. Back as kids, we used to kiss when we played truth or dare. Now she's more sophisticated, highly educated, not at all overrated. I think I need a prayer to get in a book, and it looks rather dry. I guess a twinkle in her eye is just a twinkle in her eye. Although she's crazy stepping, I'll try and stop the stride, cause I won't have no more of this passing me by.
And she must voice my opinion and be pretending she didn't have me. Sprung like a chicken, chased my tail like a doggy. She was kind of like a star, thinking I was like a fan. Dude, she looked good. Downside, she had a man. He was a Rudy, too. A naked poop. She told me, soon your little birdie's gonna fly the coop. She was a flake like corn, and I was born not to understand. By letting her pass, I have proved to be a better man.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio, 92.7, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. And introducing our first guest today, it's Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Their website is fff.org. Welcome back to the show, Jacob.
Hey, it's nice to be back, Scott.
Yeah, good to talk to you again.
Likewise.
You wrote this great article this week, and I want to start with this. I've got a few different subjects I'd like to go over with you here, actually, today, Jacob. But I want to start with your article about why Germans supported Hitler. And you know, I forget what it's called, but there's some law that says that any political debate on the internet can only go, you know, 50 responses or something before somebody calls somebody Hitler, and then that's the end of all arguments. And people kind of get sick of that, right? It's the worst of hyperbole, right? Anybody who disagrees with anybody about politics tries to make the analogy to Nazi Germany as the ultimate example of all evil that they agree with and that kind of thing. But what you've done in this article is, I think, really the opposite of that. Rather than playing into this kind of crazy hyperbole game, comparing everything to Hitler and you know, Nazi Germany as the exemplar of all evil on earth, you take us back and you ask your audience, well, look, we all agree that this is, you know, the worst form of fascism in human history. How we have to ask ourselves, why is it that the people of Germany supported it? Here, the thousand-year Reich only lasted 12 years. But how did it even last 12 years? How did the Nazis even get power in the first place? Why would the average doofus in Germany put up with the Nazi party for a week? And the way you ask the question and the way you explain your answer in this article is extremely informative and interesting to me. So I guess I'll just go ahead and see if I can just set you off on a rant about, you know, what you're trying to get at here with this article, Why Germans Supported Hitler, which just ran, I guess, late last week on LouRockwell.com.
Right. Well, what motivated me to write the article is a movie, well, two movies, actually. The Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, which is a German movie. But it's the story of the White Rose, and the story of a group of German students who began protesting in the middle of World War II against the Nazi regime. And their activities obviously were very surreptitious, very secret, because the Gestapo was searching desperately for them. What they were doing is publishing a series of little pamphlets that are very libertarian in nature called The White Rose. And they were distributing them in different parts of Germany, even though the students were located in Munich. So they're obviously risking their lives to do this. And it's one of the, I think, if it's not the most inspiring story of courage that I've ever come across, it certainly ranks in the top five. It is an absolutely incredible story. People can Google it, The White Rose, Sophie Scholl, and the movie's fantastic. It's really worth looking at. And then there was another movie called Downfall a couple of years ago, in which was the story of Adolf Hitler in the bunker. And what struck me about that movie was that his secretary, who was very young, about 21 or 22, was telling her story of, look, you know, I was offered this great job to be the president's secretary, the chancellor's secretary. I mean, who would turn down a job like that? It was a great opportunity. I was serving my country. It was wartime. And then at the very end of the movie, they have the real woman, you know, not the actress, coming on the film and saying, well, you know, after the war, I discovered that there were people like Sophie Scholl. And she says, and then I realized, my gosh, maybe I should have been asking some questions. And so that's what inspired me to write, I'd been a long time reflecting on why the German people did support Hitler. But I said, you know, this is an interesting time now that, you know, now that I've seen these two movies, you have these two young people both taking different opposite perspectives. One is standing up against its government. Their government, and they're saying, you know, this is what the true patriot does. The other one is saying, no, we've got to support our government, especially in wartime, and that's what patriotism is all about. And so I said, you know, I'm gonna write about this, and I'm gonna explore why the German people did that. Why didn't they do what Sophie Scholl did? Why did they do what this young secretary did, by and large? And why did they support their government in time of war instead of standing up against it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Two kinds of patriotism, one that gets blended into nationalism and leads to, you know, absolute hell on earth for millions of people, and the other kind of patriotism that stands the strongest against the former.
That's right. I mean, obviously I'm attracted to the Sophie Scholl type of patriotism that says, and it's the type of patriotism that characterized our founding fathers. I mean, we often forget that on July 4, 1776, those guys that signed that Declaration of Independence were not great Americans, contrary to what we've been taught. They were great British citizens. And they were as much British citizens as you and I are Americans, and they were willing to take a stand against their own government. That's what Sophie Scholl and Hans Scholl and their friends were doing. They were saying, look, genuine patriotism means examining what your government is doing, and if your government is in the wrong, then you've got to have the courage and the principle to take a stand against that government. That's the genuine patriot. That the traitor is the one that says, well, I'll abandon these well-established principles and norms of behavior in blind support of what my government is doing. And of course, we see this most often in wartime, that the German people took the position, look, once the shooting starts, the discussions are over, we've got to rally behind the troops, we've got to rally behind the government, and then that's, of course, where you have the greatest infringements on liberty is during the wartime, because people are afraid and they've got this blind support of government. Along comes Hans and Sophie Scholl, along comes Thomas Jefferson, and says, uh-uh. Genuine patriotism means you got to take a stand against your own government in order to get your country back on the right track.
Now, wartime is really what led to the creation of Nazi Germany in the first place. The Treaty of Versailles, as we all learn in elementary school, hopefully, at least back in the 80s we did.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think all too many Americans don't learn that, Scott. I mean, we all are taught in our public schools about World War II, but it's almost like World War I's gone down this memory hole. It's almost like even U.S. officials don't like to talk about World War I. But as you point out, World War I was simply the origin. It's really one big war. The World War II can be traced back to World War I, and specifically American intervention in World War I. Europe had been fighting these wars for centuries, and you had this sort of a balance of power there during World War I. They were killing off each other in equal amounts. There was a stalemate, and Wilson thought that he was going to come in and just settle Europe once and for all. He was going to bring democracy to the world. This was going to be the war to end all wars. And he gets American intervention that totally alters the balance of power in that war, and Germany is overrun, decimated, total defeat. And then you've got the humiliating Treaty of Versailles imposed, the reparations, and all that laid the groundwork for Hitler to come along and capitalize on it. And so then you end up with, of course, the 1930s, the horror of how they were treating the Jews, and then in World War II. So I've often suspected that the reason why there's not a lot of stress on World War I in this country anymore is that even the interventionists know that but for that intervention in World War I, there wouldn't have been a World War II.
That's right. And not only would there have never been a Nazi Germany, but there would have never been a Soviet Union, and there would have never been a British and French Middle East either. It was the Wilsonian intervention in World War I that finally destroyed the Ottoman Empire as well, and led to a lot of our problems in the Middle East today. As Jim Powell explains in his book Wilson's War, Lenin and Trotsky had their re-revolution in October 1917 after the original revolution in March. It took them 4 tries to be able to successfully seize power in Russia, and of course that was because Woodrow Wilson had come in with all this money in order and send his diplomats over to put the full court press on Kerensky to keep the Russians in the war even after the overthrow of the Tsar. So without American intervention in World War I, no USSR, no Nazi Germany, and no British Middle East. You go and try to count the consequences of American intervention from there in World War I from there, and it's pretty easy to see where we are today and how we got here. Jim Powell points out that Hitler began... Oh, this is something very important too, Jacob, that Wilson, because he was such an idealist, refused to accept surrender, unconditional surrender, from the German militarists. He said that wouldn't be legitimate. We must get the German Democrats, the people who were opposed to German participation in World War One all along, we must make them accept the Versailles Treaty and sign the Versailles Treaty. So Hitler then spent his whole career beginning every speech denouncing the traitors of 1918, the German Democrats who had signed the humiliating peace, because Wilson forced them to take the responsibility instead of the Germans who'd actually been waging the war.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just classic blowback and perverse consequences of this philosophy of interventionism. And, you know, that's why I keep telling people that, you know, I say, well, what should we do about Iraq? Well, obviously, you know, you pull out, but that's not the solution. If all the United States and all the American people do is withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq, nothing has been solved. And that's why we've been working so hard here, along with your group and the antiwar.com and so many others, of raising people's vision to a higher level of what Ron Paul is doing essentially now in the presidential races, challenging people to question this entire philosophy of interventionism, where the U.S. government is the international policeman, interloper, intervener, sanctioner, embargoer, foreign aid provider. I mean, if we can get people to challenge that paradigm and restore a limited government paradigm, dismantle this overseas empire where we got bases in more than 100 countries and so forth, then that's the real solution to how we get this country back on track. And the points you're raising are just classic interventionism, where one intervention has these perverse consequences that lead to new interventions, like World War One, leading to the Treaty of Versailles, leading to Hitler, leading to World War Two, and then World War Two resulting in the total communist takeover of Eastern Europe for some 45 years. That ally of the United States becomes the new official enemy, precipitating the Cold War, which means a massive military-industrial complex, the Vietnam War, the Korean War. I mean, it's just one bad history after another of this interventionism. And that's why we keep saying, you got to challenge this thing at its roots if you really want to go places in this country.
Right, you know, another part of that was backing religious right-wing crazies all throughout the Middle East to counter the communists and basically any kind of secularist in the Middle East. You know, when America supported Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athists when they took over Iraq, the CIA provided the lists of intellectuals of all descriptions to be rounded up and murdered. You know, supported the religious right-wing crazies in the Middle East this whole time against the Soviet Union, even against secular nationalist types. You know, Nasser was trying to kiss up to us, and we told him, you know, basically go screw himself, so then he turned to the Soviets. So then we, you know, created and supported the Muslim Brotherhood, or at least, you know, helped the Muslim Brotherhood grow as a counter to Nasser. And then they turn around and kill our guy Sadat. And it's just nothing but intervention, as you say, intervention begets intervention begets intervention. At some point, Jacob, it seems to me like we just have to kick the habit. We have to say, look, there's going to be consequences when we stop intervening. But guess what? There's going to be consequences if we keep intervening, too. At some point, we've just got to kick.
Well, I think that's what people are going to have to confront now. You know, up to this point, you've got these series of interventions, at least in the last 20 years or so, like Haiti or Grenada or Panama, that's against minor third world countries where regime change was fairly easy. But all of a sudden, I think they got themselves in over their head, and we kept saying this. I mean, you know, we've been in existence since 89, and from January of 1990, when we started publishing articles here at the Future of Freedom Foundation, we were saying, you know, now's the time to dismantle this thing, because you're finally going to have a crisis that you're not going to be able to deal with well. We predicted terrorist attacks on American soil before 9/11 because of this foreign policy, and I think now they're in over their heads. I think they're trapped. I mean, I don't think Bush can pull these troops out, at least not before he gets out of office. He's too concerned about his legacy. And that means I think the American people are having to confront the reality of this foreign policy, like it or not, because they can't avoid the steady stream of dead U.S. soldiers, the steady stream of Iraqi dead. And so this is an opportune time. You know, out of crisis comes opportunity, and this is the time where Americans need to talk about kicking this interventionist habit. Instead of just judging these interventions on whether they're, quote, successful or not, judge them on the morality of them. What's the morality of attacking a country that never attacked the United States, killing hundreds of thousands of people after imposing sanctions that killed hundreds of thousands of children, announcing to the Middle East that the deaths of those children were worth it, as Madeleine Albright did when she was serving as UN ambassador? I mean, this is the type of thing that gets people really angry. And, for a long time, Americans have just sort of looked the other way at CIA interventions all over the world, the U.S. government, military interventions. I think now people are starting to think about it. And that's a good thing, because I think we got a shot when people start thinking about something like this.
And, you know, even if the people on the other side of the water from here remain cartoon characters with no rights whatsoever in the mind of the average American, at some point they're going to have to confront the fact that our government is treating us like subjects of our foreign empire more and more, that we're losing our status as somehow immune from the tyranny that we send our government to go and enforce on people around the world. And, I'm going to keep beating this drum because I think it's just the greatest thing. Chalmers Johnson's new book, Nemesis, he says the Romans decided that they would rather live under their empire than give it up, and they destroyed themselves. The British, on the other hand, when it really came down to it, they preferred to give up the British Empire, or at least hand it off to us, and keep their English liberty. And we are now on the path of the Romans, and we have got to decide whether we want to be able to keep our Bill of Rights, the separation of powers, the rule of law in this country. And I don't want to, you know, fall into that hyperbolic trap of comparing everybody to Hitler and then making my argument, you know, sound especially weak, like I'm grasping at straws, which is how that argument usually sounds. But, you know, in your article here, Why Germans Supported Hitler, that ran on LouRockwell.com last week, Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation, you really do a lot to get into the head of the average German citizen during the 30s and then even during the wartime as well, and what it was going through their thought process, basically, in justifying what was happening to them. And, of course, the key to taking people's liberty away, and I think you quote Hermann Goering to this effect, is you tell people that there's an external threat. And that really was a big part of the Third Reich in Nazi Germany, was that, as you point out in your article, they had a Cold War against the Russians. And they had a war on terrorism. And as long as Hitler was protecting the German people from the Russians coming through the fold of gap, as long as he was protecting them from anarchist terrorists and communist terrorists, Jewish terrorists, or whoever he was pointing the finger at, the people of Germany were willing to tolerate not only the loss of their liberty, but the centralization of power in the hands of one man.
Well, and the point I was trying to make in there is to say, look, you know, it's easy for Americans to look at those grainy films of Hitler with his bombastic speeches and say, gosh, I would have never done that. How could those people do that? And what I tried to do in the article is I said, well, now wait a minute. Put yourself in the shoes of the average German, and then ask yourself what you would have done. And as you and I both know, the way that governments expand their power is through the best means is through crises and emergencies, because this is when people are most frightened. They're willing to go along with anything. And so we start out with the 1930s, the Great Depression. I mean, we see the similarities between Hitler's programs, Mussolini's programs, and Roosevelt's programs. And people were praising Roosevelt for all of these socialist fascist programs, the AAA, the NIRA, the cartelization of American businesses. In fact, Hitler even sent a letter to Roosevelt praising him for the policies that he was enacting and praising his methods of rolling over Congress and so forth. So it's this concept of the great leader in times of crisis. And then you've got, of course, the searing 9/11 event in German history during the Hitler regime, when the terrorists firebombed the Reichstag. Imagine if terrorists had firebombed the U.S. Congress. I mean, that's the type of thing. And so Hitler goes to the German Reichstag and said, look, give me permission to suspend civil liberties, just temporarily, to deal with the terrorist threat. And there was a big debate. And he says, look, the freedom of the German people depends on me having this power. We're in crisis. The terrorists are here. And the Reichstag gives him that permission. And, of course, it's renewed every so often, every 2 years or so. And so the temporary became permanent. And then, as you point out, as I point out in the article, you had the Cold War there with between Germany and the Soviet Union. That there, this monumental battle forming between the Soviet communists and the German Nazis, and we can certainly relate to that because we had a huge military-industrial complex and two hot wars and a Cold War because of the Soviet threat. And so, what I'm trying to do in this article is to say, you know, beware. Beware crises and emergencies, because these are big government's best friends. And that, as Santayana said, those who do not learn history are condemned to repeat it. And so it's not a matter of comparing Bush with Hitler and all this. It's saying, look at these people. Look at what happened to them. See how they traveled down this road. And beware. Caution. You put all the warning signals on so that people, at least if they continue walking down this road, they do so with all the warning flags in front of them.
You know, Jacob, I used to be a lot more of a conspiracy theorist than I am today, but I used to think it just seemed so obvious to me since I was a young kid that all empires fall. Everybody knows that. I don't even know when I learned that cliche. But everyone in America, all 300 million of us, know all empires fall. And I used to believe, and, you know, I have a lot higher standard of evidence now, I guess, but I used to believe that the people in power in America obviously know this just as well as I do, and therefore this must be a plot to destroy us on purpose, because or else how could they ignore 10,000 years of human history that says when you build an empire and you go around conquering people and robbing them, etc., that it always costs more than it benefits, and that it's the quickest way to militarize and then destroy your society. How could it be, you know, never mind all us ignorant Americans who go to government schools and don't know the first thing about history to forget in order to repeat it. But what about the people with power in this country? Don't they know that the project that they have embarked us on is 100% doomed to failure with no exceptions?
Well, I think that in their mind, the pro-empire mindset is that, look, they understand that the citizens finance this through taxes. And what their ideal is to have the goose continue to lay the golden eggs that supports this huge empire, but without picking enough feathers off the goose where they kill the goose. And so far they've done a very good job of balancing that out, where there's not a big tax protest, the Americans are meek, they're submissive, they're going along with all this, and there's plenty of golden eggs to support the empire. Now all of a sudden things are getting a little bit shaky. You'll recall that conservatives used to brag about how they brought down the Soviet empire. They made the Soviet government spend its way into national bankruptcy. Well, now you've got government spending here in this country out of control. And I think there are people getting nervous about it within the empire. I mean, certainly those of us that are in among the citizenry, we're concerned about it, and the dollar's cratering in international markets, and I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet by a long shot. You got government spending out of control. But you've also, I think, got people within the empire that are nervous about this. They see the military being torn apart with these extended terms in Iraq. You see recruitment down. People are figuring out, I don't want my kids going into this machinery. The military-industrial complex, it's still prospering. But I think everyone gets the sense that if you kill this goose, you're killing the people that are sucking off this goose. And I think that what we've got to be talking about in this country is what we're talking about on this show, is not how to reach this balance to save the empire and preserve the empire and make sure it can go and intervene in future countries. We got to restore a republic to this land, both domestically and in foreign affairs. We got to challenge the welfare state and the warfare state. And that's what we're doing here at the Future of Freedom Foundation. I think it's the only solution to the future well-being of this country as well as the liberty. And let me just add one more thing to supplement what you were saying about the liberty side of this. We have gone a long way to lose our liberties. People have traded their freedom for security since 9/11. The best example is as the enemy combatant doctrine, where the Pentagon now says we've got the right post 9/11 to pick up any American we want, anybody. And just by labeling him an enemy combatant, lock him up in a cell, torture him, do whatever we want to him, deny him a jury trial, due process, or whatever. That's not what freedom's all about.
Hey, translate some Latin for me here, Jacob. What does habeas corpus mean?
Habeas corpus is bring us the body of the person. Habeas corpus is really the linchpin of a free society. I mean, without habeas corpus, forget freedom of speech, Second Amendment, freedom of association, freedom of religion. If you don't have habeas corpus, none of those make any difference at all. Why? Because it's the greatest, most direct power that a government can have over a people is the power to simply go pick them up and put them in a jail cell and torture them and execute them, do whatever they want to them. If a government's got that power, what difference does it make that you've got freedom of speech and freedom of the press? As soon as you write something, you can say, well, I got freedom of speech. Yeah, we got the freedom to come and pick you up and put you in a cell and forever for the rest of your life and torture you. So habeas corpus was developed in British history to test a detention, an unlawful detention, where the person can file papers through his lawyer in an independent judiciary, independent court, and the judge issues a writ. It's an order, a formal order to whoever is holding a person in custody that says, bring the body of that person into this courtroom and show cause why you should not be required to release him. So as soon as that power came into existence, everything was revolutionized. Now the king could no longer just arbitrarily pick somebody up because he knew the very next day a judge would say, bring him over and let me rule on whether you've got grounds to hold him. Now, as you know, in the Military Commissions Act, for the first time, well, probably, I guess, the second time in American history, considering Lincoln, you've got a suspension, a cancellation, really, of habeas corpus. I mean, that's what the Congress did. They canceled habeas corpus for foreigners, which is really hypocritical. But obviously, if they can do it to foreigners, they can do it to Americans. And while Americans still have the right of habeas corpus, the Pentagon is still claiming the right, despite habeas corpus, to pick up people as enemy combatants. So that even if they do go to court, the Pentagon is saying, well, as soon as we have the habeas corpus hearing, once we establish they're an enemy combatant, you got to send them back to jail. And that's what they're claiming in the Padilla case, is what they're claiming in the Almari case, is what they're claiming across the board for every American.
I think the lesson that just rings so clearly between the lines of what you just said there, Jacob, is that all of this depends on the belief systems and the will of the American people. The judges have what? Bailiffs? Maybe some marshals on the state or federal level? They cannot force the police or the military to do anything. It comes down to a battle. The executive branch could kill the judicial branch in one day. The only reason that the police would have to respect, or the prosecutors would have to respect the judge's order to bring me this person and convince me that you ought to be able to continue to hold him, is because the society at large embraces that principle and demands that that principle is enforced. And if we don't believe that, we're cooked, man. That's it.
Well, that's right. I mean, our constitutional order is a very, very delicate, balanced system, and it's not so fortified that it's inevitable. I mean, you know, so far, Bush is complying by and large with court orders. I mean, he does his best to circumvent them, like Guantanamo and so forth. But by and large, you don't see him saying, "I refuse to obey." Now, once he got to that point, obviously, we're dealing with dictatorship. I mean, the just total dictatorship. He's already ignoring what Congress is doing with those signing statements, where he signs a bill but then signs a note next to it saying, I don't have to comply with this if it interferes with my commander-in-chief powers. Well, he hasn't quite done that with the judiciary, but you're right. Ultimately, how far these people go depends on public opinion. And there's a reason why totalitarian dictatorships fear ideas on liberty. I mean, imagine here, consider the Chinese government. It has essentially total power over the Chinese people. Yet it fears ideas on liberty. It has to censor the internet. It has to censor the press. Why? Because it knows the power of ideas on liberty to energize the people, to raise people's consciousness. And that can certainly happen here in the United States, where all of a sudden Americans start to realize what a crock this war on terrorism is, that it's all centered around U.S. foreign policy, that if you just stop the intervention, the terrorism disappears. So you don't need this massive war on terrorism edifice. You don't need to be invading other countries. And if Americans start to figure out these things, and they start figuring out that the heritage that they're giving up here with habeas corpus and due process and the Bill of Rights all for a crock, all of a sudden things could change very, very rapidly. A free society is where the government fears the citizens. The unfree society is where the citizens fear the government.
Now, I know you're a constitutional scholar. Oh, by the way, I haven't said it in a few minutes. Jacob Hornberger, he's a former lawyer. He's the founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, FFF.org. And I know you know this Constitution backwards and forwards. And I'm really glad that being libertarians, both you and I, we don't fall into this left-right, you know, kind of partisan trap. And I know that I can get a real straight answer from you here. I'm really torn in a sense about this unitary executive theory and the asserted power of the president to say, look, I'm not going to enforce unconstitutional laws. I don't care if the Supreme Court has called it unconstitutional or not. I'm not going to enforce one. I'm the president. I'm the boss of the executive branch. I'm the boss of all the cops in the federal government, and I will order them to only enforce this part of the law, not that, or whatever, or, you know, maybe not the law at all, although I guess he should just be vetoing, you know, unconstitutional laws in that sense. But, you know, if you were the president of the United States and Congress kept trying to pass all these laws to make you do unconstitutional things, don't you have the power to do it at a signing statement that says, oh, no, you don't. This I will interpret to mean this and not that?
Well, you know, we've got the system where if the president feels that a law is unconstitutional or invalid or just bad policy, his duty is to veto it. I mean, that's his obligation, that's his power, the power of veto. What is so deceptive about what this man is doing is he is signing the law into law and then saying, I've got my fingers crossed behind my back in an X, which means I don't have to comply with this law because I'm a wartime commander-in-chief.
And, of course, every time he does it, it's in favor of himself versus the rights of us and the powers of other branches of government, etc. It's not like he's standing up for liberty when he adds these signing statements.
Of course not. No, this is an aggrandizement of his own power. And it's a total abrogation of our constitutional system. I mean, the system is the Congress passes the law. If the president feels it's a bad law or unconstitutional law, he vetoes it. The Congress then votes on whether to override the veto, and then ultimately that law comes before the courts, and the courts decide whether it was constitutional or not, and they're the final arbiters of whether it's constitutional or not. But this system where he is claiming, I'm a wartime commander-in-chief, I'm like Napoleon, I'm like Santa Anna, I can exercise any power I want during my presidency, I don't see how that is any different from dictatorial power. I mean, it just seems to me that is what dictators do. They say, we're going to issue decrees, we're going to issue executive orders, we don't have to go to Congress to do what we want to do, we can spy on Americans, we can monitor their email, we can monitor their telephone calls, we can take them into custody as enemy combatants. It's incredible. We can spend as much money as we want to by simply printing the money and debasing the currency and causing the dollar to fall in international markets. None of this is consistent with a free society, Scott. None of it, as you well know.
Well, now let me ask you this. We're going to be talking with Greg Palast in the next hour about the U.S. attorney scandal and so forth. And part of that is that Congress And I'm sorry, I don't have all the details at my disposal right in front of me, but I think this is, you know, close enough to write. Congress has asked Harriet Myers and a couple of others to come and testify. And they have said, no, I won't come testify because the president has invoked executive privilege about the conversations you want me to testify about. And Congress has said, oh, yeah, well, we want the Justice Department, as it says in the statute, to convene a grand jury and see about prosecuting you for contempt of Congress, which is a crime. And according to the Washington Post, George Bush, and hopefully you know more about this than I do and can explain it better than me, but something to the effect of George Bush has told the Justice Department, no, you will not convene a grand jury and you will not investigate this. I'm the unitary executive. I'm the boss of the Department of Justice. And I say that I don't care what the statute says. You will not investigate the people that I'm invoking executive privilege over. And the quote from Henry Waxman, who I pull no truck for whatsoever, was, well, what's next, just abolishing the Department of Justice? And even when the Washington Post is saying, oh, my God, look at this insane power grab we've never heard the likes of before in all of history, it seems to me like that's something pretty serious going on there. I wonder if you can explain in any kind of better detail the situation there.
Well, unfortunately, I cannot, because I really haven't kept up with this scandal, but you know, to me, what strikes me about it all, and I haven't kept up with the details, is just this aura of secrecy that pervades this government. I mean, you can't have a free society when you've got all this secrecy going on in government. Seems to me that they ought to just come clean and say, sure, we'll testify about any of our decisions on these U.S. attorneys, and just send their people to go and testify. I mean, all they do is create this sense that they're hiding something. And okay, if they had a good reason for firing all these people, just get up there and say it. Get up there and testify. But it's just part and parcel of ever-growing secrecy.
Well, and what about the idea that the president can tell the Justice Department, no, you are forbidden from investigating criminality in my White House? Does the president have the power to tell the Department of Justice that?
Well, I think he does have the power. I mean, whether it's a smart political move or not, I think that's when it's time for Congress to appoint an independent counsel. But obviously, the Attorney General works for the president. Now, ideally, you'd like an independent-minded lawyer in charge of the show, but that's not the way politics works. I mean, the cabinet officials ultimately answer to the president. And I think ultimately at that point, if there is something going on in there, you know, like Watergate type thing, I think that's when you need the independent counsel. And I think Congress has the authority to do that.
Yeah. And we have Alberto Gonzalez as the Attorney General of the United States, which, you know, you think about how bad we thought of John Ashcroft when he abandoned all his former civil libertarian rhetoric and went and became this fascist attorney general. But, you know, I'd probably give my right arm to have John Ashcroft back at this point.
Well, yeah, it's like frying pan into the fire type of choice.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this guy, Gonzalez, he strikes me as the type of lawyer that just is a lackey for the president. Instead of exercising independent judgment, independent decision making, he just strikes me as the kind of guy who says, Mr. President, what do you want me to do? And that, to me, is not the ideal kind of person you want in the judiciary. It's not the kind of person you want running a Justice Department. I mean, after all, it is the Justice Department. I mean, it's supposed to be seeking justice. And I don't see how you can do that if all you're doing is saying, tell me what you want me to do, Mr. President, and I'll do it. And, you know, I haven't kept up with all his activities, but he just strikes me as that kind of lawyer.
All right. Now, is it okay if I keep you a couple more minutes here?
Sure.
Jacob Hornberger from the Future of Freedom Foundation. Did you get that link I sent you asking about that executive order that everybody's making such a big deal about in the last week or two?
It doesn't strike a bell, but I'm so far behind in my email that it's not surprising.
Yeah, okay. Well, there was this executive order, which I don't know the number of it. I couldn't find the number of it, but it's called Blocking Property of Certain Persons Who Threaten Stabilization Efforts in Iraq. And it's being interpreted in the alternative media, it seems like, to mean that the president can seize your property, Jacob Hornberger, because you make such a convincing argument against American interventionism. You're leading to the downfall of the Maliki government, USOB, and so they can come and shut down your foundation and seize your property and stop your effective arguments. Now, to me, that seems like it just doesn't ring true. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't put it past them. I could see these people, you know, attempting to just set the Bill of Rights on fire in front of all of us and say, what are you going to do about it? But something about the interpretation that I'm getting of this executive order doesn't seem right. And I was wondering if I could get somebody who actually can interpret legalese to look at it for me. But I guess I'm going to have to put that off.
Well, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I just blogged on that thing, and I'm certainly no expert on it either, but the best place to go is an article in the last couple of days by Walter Pincus in the Washington Post on it.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It is a very, very insightful analytical commentary that raises the exact kind of points that you're raising of how potentially expansive this executive order is. Even to the point of going after people who indirectly support the insurgency in Iraq by making donations to some groups or even perhaps by what they say. It is a very, very dangerous executive order, and Pincus points that out, that has ominous overtones. Now, notice, though, that while people are objecting to the substance of these executive orders that Bush has been entering for many years now, no one questions this process. I mean, this is what I find so amazing. Here this man has issued an executive order that applies to all Americans, and he has given it to the Treasury Department to interpret. Now, has this gone before Congress? Has there been a debate on it? Have citizens had input? Have they been able to write their congressman and say no? Like, have they had a chance to put amendments to it? Nothing. He just issues a decree, just like dictators do. They issue decrees, rule by decree. And all of a sudden, it's now the law, and people can lose all their assets. That's what Pincus was pointing out, that they can confiscate all your assets if you make the wrong move here. Well, I think it's time for Americans to start questioning this whole notion of these executive orders. I mean, we have a Congress. It's Congress's job to pass laws, not the president. The president's already assumed the power to declare war. Why do we want him to have the power to make laws, too? That's what dictators are all about. And so, we ought to question the substance of that executive order, plus all the others he's raised. We ought to question the process, too, Scott.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's a mark of my naivete that was actually one of the reasons that it didn't ring true, as I thought. And, you know, I've seen some pretty crazy executive orders in my time, looking through the White House websites, this president and the last one, and history books before that. But when I read this, I thought, nah, this is too much for an executive order. This would have to go through Congress. There would have to be something legalizing this. That was, you know, goes to show even how naive I am at this late date.
Well, I think the problem is that most of us just cannot believe that a lot of this is going on. I'm uploading the article right now for your listeners. It's in the Washington Post by Walter Pincus. It's called "Destabilizing Iraq Broadly Defined," and it's Monday, July 23rd, page A15. And just Google Walter Pincus Washington, on the Washington Post website, and you can pick it up. And it's worth looking at because it is a very, very ominous order. It could affect anybody in this country. It's the same type of mindset of expanding government powers.
All right. Yeah, thanks for that. Again, that's "Destabilizing Iraq Broadly Defined" by Walter Pincus. I'll be sure to look that up and read it as soon as the show's over. And one more question. You brought up Ron Paul earlier in the interview, Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation. And so I wanted to ask you a question about his campaign for the presidency. Isn't it great? Man, I'm so excited about the Ron Paul campaign, and I don't care if he gets dead last, which I know he won't. He's doing so much better than that, but this is the greatest damn thing for liberty that I've seen in America in my lifetime, and from what I know of history, probably since Andrew Jackson chased the British out of New Orleans, man.
Well, he's raising people's vision to strong principles that formed the founding of this country, this philosophy of non-intervention overseas, the opposition to the drug war that's been so horrible, opposition to welfare state programs. I mean, he's touching a lot of chords in people, chords that have been long forgotten but are deeply seated in the American people, because this was our heritage. No income tax, no welfare, no Federal Reserve System, no Social Security, no foreign wars. He's touching those chords, and he's obviously creating an enormous buzz, and he's also creating a lot of fear among the establishment people. I mean, I think it's absolutely fantastic and exciting, you know, what he's doing in the realm of politics in terms of raising people's vision to a higher level here. It's absolutely fantastic.
To my knowledge, it's the first time that central banking has been a subject of debate in a presidential campaign since 1912.
That's right. I mean, I don't know of any candidate in my lifetime that has raised the idea of abolishing the Federal Reserve, the central bank. I mean, and it needs to be abolished. I mean, they've made a disaster, beginning with the Great Depression that the central bank was the primary cause of. And then not to mention all these decades of inflation and debasement and paper money and so forth. And then we see it today with a dollar cratering. It's fantastic that you've got a candidate out there raising that issue and causing people to think about it. You know, because I often think if you can just get people to start thinking, you know, put some oil up in those gears and get the gears moving, we got a shot to getting this country back on track. Hey, Scott, could I mention one more thing before we sign off?
Sure thing. Go ahead.
You know, we had what I consider the one of the greatest conferences that I have ever participated in since I joined the libertarian movement many, many years ago, and that was held in June, called Restoring the Republic, U.S. Foreign Policy and Civil Liberties. It turned out to be a spectacular success. It's on our website. People can access it. It's on the tag that says Conference 2007. Is the greatest collection of 24 speeches I've ever heard in my life, including Ron Paul and Andrew Napolitano. We're going to be selling DVDs and CDs. We'll have those ready in about 3 weeks. We've already got Andrew Napolitano's and Ron Paul's and James Bovard's speech on YouTube. We're going to post all 24. But we invite people to take a look at those talks. Come to our website and see the schedule, because we're going to be providing the links to all the speeches. But I wanted to bring that to people's attention because, you know, this obviously is a burning issue of our time, foreign policy and civil liberties, and FFF is trying to play a leading role in raising people's vision to what the pro-freedom position is, and this is the greatest collection of speeches that I think I've ever heard on this subject. So, you know, it's at FFF.org, and then click over on Conference 2007.
Well, I apologize in advance for the lack of eloquence from what I'm about to say, but it's about the best I can do, so I'll just go ahead and say it the best I can figure out how to get it out. From what I've seen of the videos of that Future Freedom Foundation conference, the YouTubes of James Bovard and Ron Paul, the speech that Anthony Gregory gave, which ran on lewrockwell.com, and also on your site, Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org, which just knocked my socks off. That kid Anthony Gregory is just a shining light. I say all that to say this. I really think that the Future Freedom Foundation, among the very few libertarian, you know, think tanks, propaganda outfits, whatever you want to call it, I think you guys are really just leading the way, Jacob Hornberger. You're a minarchist, a constitutionalist, but you are a radical, man, and it's obvious that you put human liberty first. And, you know, you've got assembled at FFF an incredible collection of writers, the Freedom Daily and all this stuff. And to people in the audience who aren't too familiar, I just couldn't recommend the Future Freedom Foundation higher. You talk about, you know, getting the message of liberty out there. It's not a conservative message, and it's not a liberal message. It's the libertarian, individualist, human freedom comes first point of view. And it can be found at fff.org. And I thank you very much for your insight, as always, today, Jacob Hornby.
Well, thank you. The feeling is mutual, as you well know. We've got a big challenge, but it's an exciting fight. And I'm glad I'm on the same side as you, Scott.
I am too, man. Believe that. All right. Thanks very much, Jacob.
Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Drinking Manischewitz, going out to Terrad Goyam. Stop and shake it. Screwing sixes as long as we're home by Saturday morning.
Cause hey, we're the Bruce.
Sporting and I've washed the cadets. Gains through intimidation. Pacifism, no longer tradition.
Cause hey, we're the Bruce.
Sporting anti swastika tattoos.
I, we're the Bruce.
The Fairfax ghetto boys, Dean and he Bruce.
We've got the mic.
Psycho Machuca Nuts.
We can't lose the fight.
We are the chosen ones. Hurt but driven. We battle then we feast. We celebrate. We'll separate our meal plates from our meat.
We're the Bruce.
Sporting anti-swastika tattoos. We're the boys. Orthodox and city go-geoids.
All right, y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. Here in just a few minutes, we'll have the great investigative reporter Greg Pallast on the show to talk about things new, old, and interesting. And, man, I have a pile of news articles I want to talk about today that I guess I just need a three-hour show, man. I could never get through them all. I got to take you into the twilight zone with this New York Times article here by Stephen Farrell, U.S. and Iran blame, trade blame and second round of Iraq talks. And I don't blame Stephen Farrell. I think he's actually probably pretty accurately reporting the insanity that is American foreign policy. It's just it's hard to get through this thing without just laughing. I'll see if I can do it. Reporting on yesterday's talks, a second round of talks between American and Iranian diplomats produced scant evidence of progress or common ground on Tuesday, with each side emerging to blame the other for hindering progress on security in Iraq. Ryan C. Crocker, the American ambassador to Iraq, reiterated accusations that Iran was providing weapons and training for Shiite militias to attack American-led forces in Iraq, while his Iranian counterpart, Hassan Kazemi Kumi, countered that Iraqis were victimized by terror and the presence of foreign forces in their country. Well, good thing that I kind of spaced out paying attention to the bumper music while I was reading that last paragraph, because it saved me from laughing all the way through it. America is accusing Iran of backing Shiite militias. Like, say, for example, the Badr Brigades. You know, only by lying by such omission, you know, leaving out a book worth of information, can statements like that be leveled as accusations. You know, if me and my cousin are going deer hunting, and you arm and train my cousin, Well, then that's okay, right? That's not an act of war against me. Hey, thanks. I was going to have to, you know, give him some of my ammo, but you took care of it. I appreciate that. That's what's going on here. America and Iran back the same side in Iraq. The Maliki government. Iran doesn't back militias that are fighting the United States. The militias that are fighting the United States are Sunni militias. The Shiite militias are on our side. Now, America obviously works against the Mahdi army, but the level of violence directed by them at American troops is basically negligible compared to the Sunni insurgency. There's no full-scale battles going on against there certainly aren't against the Badr Brigades, but against the Mahdi army. I guess the last big one I heard about was in April when they found the EFP factory there 100 miles south of Baghdad, not in Iran, but in fact in Iraq, just like they say they have no evidence of. Here we are. Mr. Crocker from the United States State Department continuing to blame Iran for all of America's troubles in Iraq when all they're doing is trying to back the same side as us. And man, how am I, god dang, Greg's going to be mad at me because I'm going to be a couple seconds late. I have to at least tell you to go to Raw Story, or recommend to you, I guess suggest, that you go to rawstory.com and look at Larissa Alexandrovna's new article, National Intelligence Estimate Lacks Supporting Evidence, Possibly Politicized, Intelligence Officials Say. And by the way, if any of my fellow bloggers from Stress are listening to this right now, would you please post this up on Stress? This is a good one. This is about how they just kind of threw in Hezbollah as some sort of terrorist threat to America, even though that's the furthest thing from the truth. Obviously a political decision there to try to make Israel's enemies our enemies. I want to direct you to the antiwar.com blog, where there's a few great ones by, Matt Barganier and Eric Garris both. Eric Garris points us to, Rob Dreher. I don't know how to say his name anyway, but, he's one of these, pro-war Republicans who's now recanted and learned a lesson about, I no longer have confidence in the ability of our military or any military to solve deep cultural and civilizational problems through force alone. Wow, imagine that. I no longer believe the Republican Party is superior in foreign policy judgment to the Democrats. I no longer trust governmental institutions, including the military, neither in their honesty nor their competence. And you know, good for you, Mr. National Review, Rod Dreher, neocon, warmonger guy. It's late July 2007, and you admit you were wrong. Nowhere in there does he say, oh, turns out that all the people who said I was wrong all along, they were right. But, okay, that's all right, though. We can forgive him for that. But anyway, you can read about that at the Lou Rockwell, at the antiwar.com blog. Also, Matt Barganier has a funny one. Finally, an alternative to peace and freedom, where he skewers this idiot so-called libertarian Randy Barnett, who attacked Ron Paul for not being a vicious, bloodthirsty, imperialist warmonger like him, in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, fittingly enough. So Matt Barganier rips that to shreds on the antiwar.com blog. I wanted to point you that way, and you'll laugh because it's funny. Matt Barganier always is. And also I want to point you to LouRockwell.com, a great article about socialist healthcare called What Sicko Left Out by Humberto Fontova, who is from Cuba and has some perspective. I really wanted to find some time to read this whole article on the show today, but I guess I hadn't planned things out very well. Please go check that out at LouRockwell.com, What Sicko Left Out. And, and there's a great one, in the top news articles on antiwar.com today, a link to the Financial Times. Sanctions fail to fuel dissent on Iran's streets. And it's about how American, and United Nations, EU sanctions against Iran hurt private interest to the benefit of the government of Iran. Wow, I am so surprised. And also I will be amazed and astounded when no one in power in America understands. Or maybe that's their purpose. Who knows? I don't know. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm overdue. I got to get Greg Palast on the phone here. Great investigative reporter for the BBC and Harper's and I forget what else. Author of a couple of great books. So stay tuned and I'll be right back here with Greg Palast. Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
Big Dad, I want to see my boy. Anybody see my boy?
Yo. Hey, you know, my goddamn daughter's missing too. What the fuck happened?
Hey, what's going on with your goddamn son? Big Dad coming out.
Yo, man, he cut out with that D in that shit.
God,
he cut out with the D in the shit, man.
Give me another bell.
Greg Palast will be coming up right after this, folks, on Anti-War Radio, Radio Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
Same old lies. Don't tell me that today, yes, and that one's good for you. You'll get out of my way, cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulders. Going faster. I won't apologize for acting out of line. You see the way I am. You leave anytime you die, God. I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulders. Going berserk.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And introducing my next guest today, Greg Palast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. He's a reporter for BBC Newsnight and writes occasionally, I guess, in Harper's and I forget where else. But glad to have you back to the back on the show here, Greg Palast. Are you there? Can you hear me? Nope. Oh, I lost my connection. Well, shit. Here's some more music again, then. This is Iron Maiden. You knew that. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott. Thanks for listening. Next guest is Greg Palast. He writes for Harper's, does TV news for BBC Newsnight. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. Welcome back to the show, Greg.
Scott, great to be here.
It's good to have you on. Now, every time we speak on the show here, we end up talking about Iraq and the oil law and all that. But we only have a limited amount of time here. It's something we got to cover, but I don't want to, just duplicate an old interview. So let me try to sum up my understanding as best as I can, and then we can move on from the oil law, where it stands now, and what the point is, and et cetera, like that. So
right.
Here's my best shot at telling your story about the oil thing.
Go. Okay, do me.
All right, I'll do my best, and I'll try to do it faster than
you
do.
Are you bald? That's what you got to do. Okay.
All right, so here's the deal. The Houston oil guys and the New York Rockefeller Council on Foreign Relations types, Colin Powell and them, they wanted a war with Iraq, too. The sanctions were going to be lifted at some point in the Bush administration. Something had to be done. But what they wanted to do was a decapitation-type situation, an invasion disguised as a coup d'etat, you call it, replace Saddam Hussein with the next Ba'athist general in line and keep everything else as is, and get a compliant Ba'athist in there. The neocons, on the other hand, in their vision of American empire, includes a lot of benefit to Israel as well. And what they were more interested in this case, was rapidly privatizing every little bit of Iraqi oil in order to lower the price so low that it would weaken the Saudi regime and they would be overthrown, lose their dominance in OPEC, and the new American client regime in Iraq would be the new leader of OPEC and maybe an alliance with Iran after we regime change them, and they would destroy Saudi Arabia, which they saw as a big threat to Israel. And the neocons got a lot of what they wanted in the war, but the oil men pulled out their trump cards when it came to what was to happen to the oil. And they said, no, you're not going to privatize Iraqi oil and dump the price of a barrel down to 10 bucks and bankrupt the Saudis. The Saudis are our friends, and they do what we want and vice versa. And that's not going to happen. We're going to have a national government oil company in Iraq that's going to abide by the quotas as set by the Saudis and be a good little Arab client state under the direction of our longest ally there, the Saudis. Is that basically right?
Sounds pretty good. I'd buy that book.
Okay, yeah, it's okay. Good. It's called Armed Madhouse, everybody. Run out and get it. You got to say that four times per Greg Palast interview. Okay, now, so the question is, here's this the benchmark for the phony timeline with the giant loopholes that you could drive a war through and everything, but the so-called timeline and benchmarks and all that mandates that the Iraqis get their act together and pass an oil law that they say the purpose of it is to divide up the spoils in a fair way to the different ethnicities, the different tribes, the different geographical sectors of the country, since the majority of the oil revenue or the oil resources are up near Kirkuk in the north and down near Basra in the south, and not so much where the Sunni Arabs live. And so they say that, listen, this is part of creating a coalition government so that the civil war will end so that we can leave, is so that we got to have this oil law to divide up the oil fairly. Okay, so now, Greg, tell me why that's wrong.
So let's see now. American oil companies, U.S. generals, remnants of the neocons have all gotten together and decided to be fair.
That's right.
They want everything to be fair in Iraq.
That's
okay.
What it says in the Times.
And that's why we're staying there. And, well, let's just remember this, right? They originally called it Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. That's maybe a little bit droll, but let's not forget that that really was the name that they gave to it. Now, the liberation ain't there, but the oil still is. What's going on here? First of all, we tell the world this has nothing to do with oil, but we say we will only keep our troops in if you pass an oil law that we want, and by the way, that we wrote. Just so you know, for those who haven't, God forbid, read Armed Men out, we have in there the information that the oil, what is today the oil law of Iraq being proposed, was written by James Baker and his crew in Houston, by big oil executives and big oil consultants. And it was jammed down the Iraqis' throat, or they're trying to jam it down the Iraqis' throat right now. Now, and in other words, we're not there for the oil. Let's put it this way. We didn't go in for the oil, okay, if that's the claim, but we sure as hell ain't leaving without it. Now, that's the benchmark. We're saying we will only keep our troops in if you give us the oil law we want. And yet this isn't about the oil. How did oil become a benchmark? Like you say, the phony cover is having to do with some type of fairness. Like, suddenly we really care about being fair to the Sunnis. All right.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Right.
What it is about is enforcing this plan of the big oil company. When they're talking about a fair division, it's not between the Sunnis and the Shia and the rest. It's dividing the Iraq's oil between Shell and British Petroleum and yeah, ExxonMobil and Chevron. It's that division that they're talking about.
So now, why
do they need this oil law to do that? The answer is that contracts have already been let by the Kurdish warlords. Oh, excuse me. The Talabani, the president of Iraq, otherwise known as a bloodthirsty, cold-blooded warlord of Kurdistan, and Barzani, his other fellow warlordship. They've already cut deals with these dinky oil companies, Ivanhoe, Crescent, and others. Now, did they take kickbacks to go with these little biters? I'm not saying that. Does anyone take kickbacks in oil in Iraq?
No.
Far be it from me to suggest that.
Obviously.
In addition,
not.
On the Shia side, you've got a short-fingered swindler named Ahmed Chalabi, convicted bank swindler, who was oil minister, named himself oil minister. And God knows what deals have been cut there. The mm-hmm. problem is that big oil guys told me when you have Chalabi, who's a crook, and you've got warlords in the north, and they are going off and cutting deals on their own. Big oil gets cut out, or big oil has to buy their way in and give extra slices. They have to basically, Ivanhoe ain't drilling any oil. Crescent ain't drilling any oil. They will then go back and resell to the big oil majors, but that cuts the take of Texas boy. So what's happening here is the big boys are saying, we expect the central government to rip up these contracts that are already in existence. Pre-Saddam, now the new warlords of North and South, and now centralize it and cut what are called profit-sharing agreements, PSAs, sometimes they're called production-sharing agreements, with us. And the new oil law basically requires approval of all contracts by the central government. It sets up a system of production-sharing agreements, the old PSAs, so that the big boys can have a slice. And it will all be controlled centrally through a central oil, state-owned oil company, which will be able to use force, police power of the state to enforce its will over all the areas to make sure that Exxon, Chevron, Shell, et cetera, get their slice. And I didn't get this from, this isn't like a fantasy deal. Noam Chomsky thinking it through and undoing the puzzle from a distance. This is from talking to people like the former CEO of Shell, who was sent there by Bush to set up the oil regime.
Right. And it's all in the book, Armed Madhouse. That's three. Okay,
that's
so
great.
So I want to dwell on this point just a little bit, if you'll let me. I just think it's so much fun that a bunch of former communist radicals wanted to privatize all the oil in Iraq, treat the land which the oil is under as private property and turn it over to the free market. Let Ivanhoe or whoever come in and produce that oil. And big business, the actual capitalists, the actual oil men from Houston, wanted no such part of that whatsoever and instead want a nationalized government tyranny over that oil to then cut them in on gigantic contracts so that they do the pumping and the transporting and make the majority of the profits off of all of the oil.
Right. Your general split is 16-84, 84% of the oil companies. That's the kind of general number that you're looking at.
Absolutely criminal.
And, well, they would say that it's absolutely efficient. Now, the problem is that what it isn't is a way for us, you know, for those of the pro-invasion freaks like Thomas Friedman, who were there to admit that we were there for the oil. Like Friedman said, well, why, yeah, we're there for the oil. Isn't it better that the land of the free and the home of the brave have control of the oil as opposed to, like, you know, a mustached maniac like Saddam? You know, there's a point to that. The problem is we're not getting the oil. The oil companies are not interested in finding oil. They're interested in finding profit. And the point of the whole setup in Iraq is, yes, to give them the big slice, but not necessarily to actually produce the oil. They're happy to keep the oil limited. You know, before the tanks rolled, well, when Clinton was in office, oil was about $18 to $20 a barrel. Now you're at, what, $73 a barrel this week?
Yep.
You're going from $18 to $73 a barrel. That's mission accomplished.
Yeah, very important.
That's
point
the
there.
Point.
Very important point there for people who lean left in the audience to understand. Oil is a big part of this, but it's not going to steal the oil for cheap for our greedy SUVs and so forth. It's, as Greg Palast just explained, to redline that oil, to keep it off the market so they make, you know, the oil resources that they already control all of a sudden are now worth so much more, sitting in, you know, on the asset side of their ledger. by using government force in an oil cartel system to keep oil off the market and prices artificially high. Make more money for doing less work. That's what you'd do with police power if you had it too, right?
Yeah, well, and there's one other thing, by the way. When you talked about, you know, everyone says, well, there's not real any real oil in the Sunni areas. That's not true.
It's just not developed.
When Churchill created Iraq, he combined what he thought were three oil fields, Basra, Kirkuk of the north, the Kurdish areas, and then the Sunni areas around Baghdad, which have huge tar sands but are known to have huge oil deposits. In fact, a little known fact for you, but you love the little known.
Uh-huh.
And now we'll reveal it, rip away the veil. The Iraqi government just paid the oil majors millions and millions of dollars for their oil maps of Anbar province, where apparently there are huge deposits of untapped oil. Huge, monstrous, gigantic. When they're talking about Anbar province and they're saying, well, that's the poor Sunni area. No, that's the untapped oil area.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're fighting over Anbar, they're fighting over the next big field there. Not that they want to drill it. They want to make sure no one drills it. You think that these guys are crying about $74 a barrel oil?
Well, let me ask you this,
Greg.
The
last thing they want to do is start flooding the market. That's what they're afraid of. They were afraid not that Saddam would remove oil from the market. After all, we had something called the Oil for Food Program, which kept the lid on things. They got very little food. We got very little oil, and the oil majors were very happy. They're not there to get the oil. They're there to control and limit the output of it. And whatever there is, they want the biggest slice, but they want to make sure that the pie ain't too big, because the more oil out of Iraq, the less the value of the oil out of Louisiana. That's how it works.
Oh, wow. Okay, here comes number four. Armed Madhouse is the name of the book. It's by Greg Palast. You can go. It's even in paperback now.
Yeah.
We'll see if we can push it and maybe get five in here for you. But let's switch gears here from the oil.
That's overdoing it.
Yeah, oh yeah, it might be. And by the way, anybody can go to the anti-war radio section at antiwar.com and find the transcript of a previous interview, also the audio archive, on which the entire interview was on this subject in much greater detail. Anybody wants to get further into that. But I also want to know about this U.S. attorney thing. It's something I've paid as little attention to as possible, but I know that it has a lot to do I don't know this. I've heard that it has a lot to do with Republicans in the White House, the political operative types like Karl Rove, trying to get U.S. attorneys around the country to maliciously prosecute Democrats for voter fraud. Basically, I guess at least some of the people who got fired were the ones who stood up against this pressure. Is that right, Greg?
You got it. I mean, one of the things that I was investigating for a book I won't mention, but for the BBC, was something called cagingless. We discovered that the Republican Party had this whole scheme to send out letters to poor voters, black voters, basically Democratic concentrated areas. When people weren't there, the letters would come back, and then they had a grounds for challenging their vote. Now, altogether, through this and many, many other methods, 3 million votes were challenged in the 2004 election. That's a heck of a 3 million votes. That's from, you know, from the data of the Elections Assistance Commission of the U.S. So you got 3 million votes that were challenged, cast, not counted. Now, to do this, they used this phony method of tagging voters as fraudulent. Now, was there a big crime wave of millions of fraudulent voters? No, because if there were, they would have arrested them. It's against the law. It's a felony in every single state to vote illegal, to vote when you don't have the right to vote. But you're now blocking people by the thousands and thousands and thousands from voting. You got to justify this stuff, and they're cranking up the system. They're creating a new system of ID cards, et cetera, to do this. So what they wanted to do, what Karl Rove was very intent on, and I'm not guessing about Rove. Rove was extremely intent upon getting some prosecutions of people on these lists. And what happened was that his own appointed U.S. attorneys, you have to understand, these U.S. attorneys that were fired were good Republicans, loyal, like David Iglesias, whom I spoke to from New Mexico, U.S. attorney for New Mexico. He said they gave him 150 names of so-called fraudulent voters, and he said it was bogus. He was you have to understand, Iglesias is an Ashcroft Republican protege. And he says this stuff was bogus, and he wouldn't bring the cases. And here's the other trick. Not only is it did he find the cases bogus. But even if he found them, the U.S. rules of conduct for U.S. attorneys bars him from bringing those cases because they would affect elections. You can't bring cases before an election that would affect an election. You can't bring individual case against individual voters unless there's a large conspiracy to manipulate the election. These are, you know.
Otherwise, that would be a state matter, right?
Yeah, it would be a violation of the state if he had. But he said there were no cases to even turn back to the state. He used the FBI. He said he really looked at these things, and it was bogus. They just wanted to bring phony cases, bust anyone, and hope that someone would be intimidated into pleading guilty. You know, brought up on federal charges. This is big stuff. So this is baloney to justify this attack on voters. And he got fired for it. He got fired for it. And no question about that's what was up. And by the way, yesterday we found out something else from the hearing. When I just said it was against the rules of conduct, in May of this year, the rules of conduct were changed. There's a little rule book for U.S. attorneys that they have to follow. Without any notice, Gonzalez's people rewrote the rule book. Someone rewrote the rule book, and Gonzalez was asked about that. They took out the stuff that says you cannot. It says there's all these rules that say the U.S. attorneys cannot use their office to manipulate elections, use voter fraud cases to manipulate elections. All that was removed. It was like 1984. They just removed it from the rule book. And no one, and Gonzalez was asked, why did you make these changes? He says, I don't know. Now, of course, everyone loved that because he just looked like a complete dummy. His own rule book was changed. But I understood why they changed it. They wanted to use these U.S. attorneys as hitmen to manipulate the election. They want to take out anything that stopped them from manipulating elections and using the federal office to do so. Now, what the follow-up question that was missing, and I was disappointed, was if you didn't make these changes, Mr. Gonzalez.
Who did?
Who did?
Uh-huh.
And is Mr. Rove going to explain why he did it? Okay, now.
So you.
One other thing to add in here. It's not just who they fired, it's who they hired. In the state of Arkansas, after firing Bud Cummins for refusing to bring these phony cases, they hired and put in his place a guy named Tim Griffin. Remember I mentioned the caging list?
Mm-hmm.
Who was the guy who sent out the caging list?
Mm-hmm.
Tim Griffin. So the guy that was involved in this election manipulation, this trick of challenging innocent voters, and they lost their vote, which is, by the way, a crime. You can't do that. That's a violation of the Voting Rights Act. And using mail, it's voter fraud. The perpetrator became the prosecutor. They named him U.S. prosecutor for Arkansas. Now, what happened was is that John Conyers asked BBC for its information about Griffin, the new U.S. attorney's, about his involvement in caging. We announced that on the air in London. And Griffin resigned by the next morning in tears, blaming a reporter he won't name, but you may.
Congratulations, Greg. I like it when government employees lose their jobs because of you. That's always good. Pat yourself on the back there, bud.
Yeah, but you know what? It was like there was complete silence here in the USA on that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the only reason that I know that this has anything to do with elections is because I read your blog and I read the blog of the other Scott Horton, the heroic anti-torture lawyer, and mm-hmm. because I'm good friends with your assistant and I talk with her on the phone all the time and she fills me in on all these gaps. But I'll tell you what, I could tell you from watching The Daily Show every night and watching cable TV news, I know that some U.S. attorneys were fired, but I don't know why.
Yeah, well, and yesterday, by the way, there was no coverage at all on National Petroleum Radio, et cetera, of the hearings yesterday, which were shocking. And today, the New York Times, as usual, they concentrate on the one thing, the Ashcroft, you know, that Gonzalez. Now, these are, by the way, for those who did miss it, Attorney General Gonzalez was questioned yesterday for like 8 hours by the Judiciary Committee of the Senate.
Was it that long?
I was stunned. They just wouldn't let him go. I've never seen someone take such a pounding ever. But that's what I'm worried about. He first of all, and I don't say this lightly, I've never seen a witness like that just lie and lie and lie as number one. I mean, it was like the perjury dance of the seven veils. I've never seen anything like it. And in addition, you know, just acting like a complete fool. He was barely covering up his prevarication. And all I kept thinking of is what the committee's doing is showing that, telling us that Pinocchio's head is wooden and he's got a long nose. And that they are, they were doing, both Republicans and Democrats were doing an excellent job of kicking Pinocchio around the room. And I kept saying, why are they kicking the puppet? Where's the puppeteer here?
Right. You know, it's
where
funny.
Is the puppeteer? Where is? We know, for example, that Gonzalez went to Ashcroft, who may have been, you know, like sedated, maybe dying, who knows what, in his hospital bed, and practically wanted to like grab his hand and have him sign some papers to allow the continuation of the U.S. KGB operation, spying on U.S. citizens.
The phone tapping, yeah.
Yeah. You know, if he wanted that, you know. And so they're making, you know, they're attacking him on that. But what do you think? Gonzalez just decided on his own, I'm going to, I'm going to do a Brezhnev on my own?
No,
he was with
Andrew
Card, one of the creepiest chiefs of staff ever, and that's saying a lot given that Dick Cheney was a chief of staff. Okay. I mean, you know, you're talking about a guy who makes Cheney look like, you know, Mary Poppins Card. And he was with Gonzalez. They're not asking about the fact that the, you know, Gonzalez kept saying, I have nothing to do with the firing of U.S. attorneys. First of all, that's shameful. He is the United States Attorney General. If you're going to fire U.S. attorneys, he's supposed to be the guy doing it. They said, I don't know anything about it. Well, then let's talk to the guy who did it. He was handed the list by Carl Rove. Tim Griffin, who did this caging operation, was the assistant to Carl Rove. Tim Griffin says, and I actually don't doubt him, he didn't know what caging was. That's one of the things he said when he was asked, unfortunately, by a Swiss reporter, not an American reporter, when he resigned, what about the caging list? He said, I don't know about what caging is. Well, the answer is, he says that's a term used in direct mail. Well, guess what? Who owned a direct mail firm before he went to work in the White House?
Carl Rove. Yeah.
So was Carl Rove behind the caging of voters, which is an illegal activity? So, you know, again, you're right on and, you know, and correct in bringing it down to its point. The whole point of the prosecutor firing was to set up to manipulate, to cover up what they did in 2004 and prepare to steal 2008. And remember, and while you're correct in saying it's partisan, that is, it's by Republicans for Republicans, I look at this more as an elite, a class elite within one party,
mm-hmm.
That is trying to maintain the control by this elite. I'm not even sure, in a way, it's a coup d'etat that they've engineered, an electoral coup d'etat in 2000, 2004. They're ready to do it in 2008. I'm not sure doing it for Republicans, per se, but, you know, when you're talking about go back, you know, it all connects up. You know, if you're going to have James Baker and Klan, and the oil companies writing the oil laws for Iraq, you know, then you have to ask yourself, for whose benefit is this being done? And I think it is something worse than partisan political manipulation. I think it's a manipulation by a very dangerous elite, which does not intend to give up power, and I'm not sure it's necessarily completely partisan.
Uh-huh. And now, when you say that, can you narrow that down? I mean, you're talking about the oil men in Houston, or who else?
Well, you know, I mean, they don't exactly invite me into the club, or I don't know their special handshake. You know, I'm not one of these people who thinks they, you know, that just everyone that still has a skull and bones ring, you know, in their closet. But it's but there's no question that there is special control of our political structure by the oil and extractive industry. We now have finance capital deeply involved in the direction of our nation, everything from our tax codes, our budgets, and where we send our tanks. So I'm, you know, that's a big wider issue that probably is beyond anything I can intelligently handle in a very short time, or I'm not even sure I can intelligently handle it all. It's probably you're better at that stuff than me. I just, you know, tend to be a toiler, a fact farmer, so to speak, you know, a fact miner, and you know, look, you know, digging out my bits that I can from these guys. You know, in the case of the caging list, it was missent emails sent to a joke website.
Yeah,
and it was redirected to me at with our BBC team. And we, you know, investigated, Lenny Von Eckert, who's a chief investigator, has done tremendous follow-up work on this stuff. And, you know, that's all we can do. And then, we tend to find the dots, and you can connect them up. So I'm not sure I'm even qualified to make a grand statement.
I'm not any better really at connecting them up than you, but I like to wonder about it. You know, there's a lot of places where I would wish to be a fly on the wall and know what these people are really talking about. But, let me ask you about Hillary Clinton. I want to give you a chance here, Greg Palast, to prove that you're not some Democratic Party, liberal hack or something who just spends his life hating George Bush as his motivation for all his reporting, which, of course, would be, you know, just about the best criticism somebody could probably try to come up with for you.
I just asked by a PBS reporter, aren't you just anti the Bush administration? I said, well, yes, I'm anti every administration.
Right.
that's what you're supposed to do if you're an investigative reporter.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. I was reading through your blog, and I said, oh, good, here he is attacking Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And, wow, it was substantive, too.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a difficult thing. And, by the way, just on this issue of attacking, you know, it's like, and of generally investigating the whole crew, there is a very powerful political feminist organization that when I first did my investigation of Hillary Clinton back in 2000, and when she was first running for Senate, I was viciously attacked. How could I dare go after this progressive Democratic woman? And I said, well, how about corruption? Let's start there. Let's start with the C's. We can work our way through the alphabet. And just last year, the very same group, and I love them. Well, there they are. The very same group took the very same article that they had attacked me on, and they reprinted it and sent it out all over the place. Because by this time they decided that Hillary, you know, being a warmonger and toady to the military industrial machine, had to be outed. So basically, I'm not going to try to annoy everyone and let everyone else catch up. So yeah, in the case of Hillary, there are tremendous problems. And in fact, one thing I didn't have in the article that you read, and I don't think we can dismiss it. I mean, we do have the very big problem of, you know, when people are screaming about the pardon of Louis Libby, which is, in my opinion, itself an impeachable act. Okay. And do understand, and I thank reporter Linda Starr for making note of this to me, that when the power of impeachment was created within the Constitution, one of the reasons it was created was to prevent the president from handing out pardons to cronies involved in crimes of which he was a part.
That's exactly right. Hamilton in the Federalist Papers wrote
it
exactly that.
It was not only Hamilton. You had Madison. You had several. I mean, that was one of the reasons for the power of impeachment, because they said, look, you have a chief executive must have the power of pardon.
Right.
Because you have to have temper justice with mercy. It's basic. You have to have the power of pardon. But you can't let someone pardon themselves. No man can be their own judge. And that means you can't pardon your cronies and your co-conspirators. And here he did it. But then, you know, I'm sorry, Democrats. But you know, the Bill Clinton's Pardons R Us operation at the end of his term was one of the most sickening sale of indulgences I have ever seen. When he pardoned the arch criminal, Swiss criminal, Mark Rich, I was ready to vomit. And then how does this get back to Hillary? Who is Hillary's big crony funder? Mark Rich's supposed ex-wife. Technically they're divorced. So her condos and mansions in the U.S. and her socialite, you know, party plates can't be confiscated by the Fed. This guy is wanted. This is a master international financial criminal. And Clinton pardoned, Bill Clinton pardoned him for his crimes in the U.S.
And this guy was a serious criminal, too. Like, wasn't he involved in the rape of Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union?
Oh, my God. He's still taking his hunk.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy controlled controlled the metals trade out of Russia after the fall of the wall. He immediately moved in, and it wasn't done because he was a smart businessman. I can't go into the details, but the stories I know personally of some pretty heavy muscle work there. This guy is no sweetheart. There's a reason why he is wanted all over the planet, and Clinton pardoned him. You also had the crazy thing where Hillary running for U.S. Senate got a pardon for some Hasidic rabbis who were convicted, involved in some type of financial manipulation, got them pardoned so she could, so they would line up their troops behind her for the senatorial vote. I mean, it was ill-making.
Yeah, well, and, you must so be that, an anti-Semite.
I mention that because I want, I'm not even mentioning the stuff that I have in my, as you said, the blog, which, by the way, was originally printed in the Guardian Sunday paper, The Observer.
Uh-huh. Well, I think you're probably just an anti-Semite is why you're picking on her for those, Mark Roach and the rabbi. Right, Greg?
Of course. Of course you're going to be accused of everything.
Yeah, okay.
It's always so.
That was a
big
joke.
And, scoundrel time.
Yeah, to make
everyone,
up for that, I'll say our madhouse again.
George Galloway now has finally been nailed in Britain. I mean, that was another one. The left hated me because I unfortunately found myself in the position. I was going to be writing a defense of George Galloway, the member of parliament who's being accused of all these evil things, taking money from Saddam's associates, being on the payroll of a dictatorial regime, self-dealing, misusing funds from a charity that was supposed to help Iraqi kids. I mean, they accused this guy of every evil under the sun, and just because he was a leader of the anti-war movement in Britain. And our very good investigator, Lenny von Eckert, I was going to write a defense of this guy. And then, oops.
Still there?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, went in and investigated. That's Cheney on his
mic. Yeah, yeah.
Really.
National Security Agency.
So, investigatrix von Eckert went in, and sure enough,
it turned out the guy was indefensible.
He was true, and worse. And so I was stuck now with this information that an anti-war leader was, in fact, a corrupt, nasty, evil toady of a dictator. And so I had to write it that way. And boy, did I get banged by the left on that how could I do that? And he was the one who started bringing up, that it was the Jewish conspiracy that put me up to this.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah.
What can you do, man?
Yeah, it's
what
one
can
thing
you do?
Or another.
I'm not saying I'm a man for all seasons. I'm just saying that I'm in a very special position where I have been allowed to write and do reports that other reporters can't do. It's not that I'm such a genius, but I do have to say that our investigating team, and certainly Lenny's a genius, but I would say that this is stuff you ain't going to get on the National Petroleum Radio broadcast, and certainly not on your Foxified network.
Yeah, well, the real difference is you're actually trying. So I guess, that puts you light years ahead of the rest of them. I'm sorry that I'm not going to give you a chance to tell us what you know about Al Gore. We'll have to save that for another time.
Ooh.
But look,
you're really
already
setting me up for trouble.
Oh,
I'm working on a piece right now called Gore No More.
Oh, good. Wait. But we don't have time for that. And in fact, we're already over time, but this is pirate radio, so I can just barely get away with it. But I got to really quick get you to rehearse for me the anecdote from your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, about the deal that the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate made that we will not include any of Bill and Hillary Clinton's corruption in their relationship with the Lippo Group based out of Indonesia and Beijing and the Riotti family, as long as you guys promise not to bring up our corrupt law-breaking in financing the election of 1994 with Koch family money.
That's right. So basically, the two parties traded billionaires. Those who say that Clinton committed no impeachable crimes, I'm sorry, guys. I hate to disappoint you, but very much so. It is completely illegal to take foreign money or money arranged by foreigners to run a U.S. campaign. Plus, there was payoffs. Clearly, Hillary's former law partner was paid off to be silent. I'm sorry, that's what the evidence stone cold indicates. And Bill Clinton lied through his teeth, except, by the way, when the FBI put him under oath, which is why I know that his public statements were lies, because he said different things to the FBI under oath. I won't go into all the details, but let's put it this way. The Clintons were guilty, but they had a couple cards in their own deck to play, the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers were billionaires who were secretly financing Newt Gingrich and his push to take over, his successful push to take over Congress with $25 million. In the old days, it was cheap to buy Congress, $25 million in illegal last-minute campaign contributions, running smear campaigns the last days of the campaign, which wiped out the marginal Democrat. Now, what they did was a crime. And they had several other crimes, including environmental crimes, including stealing oil from Indian reservations. I mean, these guys, piece of work. But it was a trade of billionaires, the Riyadi, the Indonesian billionaires of the Clinton, for the Republican billionaires. It was a drop-hands operation. Fred Thompson, by the way, was the guy who actually wanted to investigate all of it.
Right.
But Trent Lott stepped in and said, let's, you know, Mr. Loveboat, remember that was his last claim to fame, not Law and Order. Dear Mr. Loveboat, that ain't how it's done here in Congress. And frankly, while I give Thompson some point for beginning the investigation,
he never followed through.
The fact that he backed down right away, as far as I'm concerned, makes him a co-conspirator, not a contender.
Absolutely. Yep. All right.
So have we dissed enough candidates?
Man, actually, my list is getting long here, and no, we only had an hour, and we already pushed it by 5 minutes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Greg, let's do this again sometime, and you can tell us about facts that you have investigated and uncovered about politicians that I don't like and want dirt on.
Okay. Even the ones you do like, unfortunately. If you have any.
Well,
GregPalace.com if people want to follow up and see the latest.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. There's one politician that I like, Ron Paul, and the guy's middle name is Ernest, and he's been married to the same lady for 50 years, and I can't imagine it's in his character to commit a single act of perfidy. I'd love to see an investigative reporter actually try to find some dirt on Ron Paul. I don't think it exists.
When he gets more than 5% of the vote, the investigation.
All right, yeah, okay, there you go. As soon as he gets 5% in the polls, Greg, you launch your investigation and tell me what you come up with there.
Okay.
All right.
You got it.
Thanks very much for your time today. Greg Palast, everybody, author of number 6 here, Armed Madhouse.
Okay, take it easy.
Take low, a bootleg is going side of the record, the record low. The gimmick in this, how can you freestyle? 'cause I'm a